Why should Canada sign the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons when it doesn't even have nuclear weapons? Could the anti-war movement successfully make the prohibition of nuclear weapons the issue in the 2025 federal election? Are policies of actually using nuclear weapons and winning on the strategic drawing boards of the United States? Are innovations in recent years, such as the Oreshnik missile and big nations playing both U.S., NATO, and Russia sides, making new winnable nuclear war power scenarios obsolete? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with the new Cold War evolving into hot wars on all fronts, we take a look at the forbidden scenario of a nuclear conflagration eventually emerging unless people around the globe can stop it in time to save the planet and themselves. In our first half hour, we speak once again to prominent Canadian anti-war activist Tamara Lawrence about the petition circulating recently trying to get Canada to prohibit nuclear weapons in the world. Then, in our second half hour, we hear from the award-winning geopolitical and military analyst Drago Buznik about the multiple scenarios by which warfare might escalate to the nuclear level and of the possible cost of doing nothing in the face of the emerging threat of atomic disaster. On this week's program, World War III in 2025, the relentless Western push for nuclear Armageddon. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 3rd, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization, produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We aim to reverse patterns of settler colonialism and genocide in the past, reconciliation and reparations in the present, and respectful partnership in the future with the Indigenous people who were on the land first. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Keeping in view the disturbing trends, perhaps we can start by wishing for what should be avoided at all costs. In this context, it is clear that what the world should be most concerned about is to avoid any possibility of a world war or a nuclear war. In fact, the world should keep miles away from any such possibility or brinkmanship relating to this. Normally, there should be no need for emphasizing so obvious a fact. Unfortunately, in recent times, the safety norms in this context were violated in a very reckless manner, and this is why it has become essential to list this at the top of the priority list. That comes from the article, New Year Thoughts, What the World Needs in 2025 and Beyond, by Bharat Dogra, posted December 31st. For her part, the Danish PM had decided that, quote, the time when you buy and sell other countries and populations is over. Let's leave it there, unquote. Trump's imminent return to the White House has revived old idiosyncrasies. Over the holiday period in December 2024, he had moments of Jeffersonian fancy, promising to take over the Panama Canal, which he regarded as being operated illegally albeit lovingly, by, quote, the wonderful soldiers of China, unquote, turning Canada into the 51st state, with former hockey professional Wayne Gretzky installed as governor, and purchasing Greenland. The president-elect's choice of U.S. ambassador to Denmark is seemingly premised on wooing Copenhagen, with Trump declaring Washington's ownership of the territory, quote, an absolute necessity, unquote. That comes from the article Greenland Redux, Trump and America's Continuing Obsession, by Dr. Benoit Campmark, posted December 31st. According to this Nouvelle Observateur, 1998, interview with Zbigniew Brzezinski, the CIA's intervention in Afghanistan preceded the 1979 entry of Soviet troops. To label this as the Soviet-Afghan War is a misnomer. Confirmed by Brzezinski, it best described as the, quote, U.S. Al-Qaeda war against Afghanistan, unquote. The U.S. started this war against the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan with a view to destroying a secular nation-state committed to women's rights and universal public education. That was from the introduction under the headline, quote, yes, the CIA entered Afghanistan before the Russians, unquote, Zbigniew Brzezinski. By Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Professor Michel Chostovsky, and Le Nouvel Observateur, posted January 1st. Increasingly, the BRICS seem to be emerging as a kind of, quote, alternative world organization, unquote. While the UN seems to be obsolete in the face of the reality of the contemporary world, the BRICS are proving to be a viable alternative for emerging countries to come together, discuss relevant issues, and make joint decisions. In the end, 2024 was an ambiguous year, with victories and defeats for the multipolar powers in their struggle for a reconfiguration of world geopolitics. Conflicts will continue, and there will be many battles in this great global war against Western hegemony. The more reactive the West becomes, the more blood is spilled. But it already seems impossible to prevent the final outcome of this struggle, a multipolar world's victory. It comes from the article 2024, Year of Both Victories and Defeats in the Struggle for Multipolarity, by Lucas Leros de Almeida, posted January 1st, originally published on InfoBricks.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
One concern seemingly not that much on Canadians' minds is what the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists estimate is the highest risk ever of global catastrophe as the clock reads 90 seconds to midnight. One Canadian has been involved in educating people across the nation of the terrible risk and has organized a petition calling on Canada to demand the federal government sign and commit to ratifying the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that is committed to meeting in New York 2 months from now. Tamara Lawrence is a member of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace. Tamara is also a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada and a fellow with the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. As well, she is on the advisory committee of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. World Beyond War and the No to War, No to NATO Network. And she joins us now to talk about the petition, the treaty, and of the increased threat of nuclear exchange as she sees it.
You and, I guess, the Voice of Women and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada have launched a petition on October 8th calling for Canada to finally sign the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Is that correct?
Yes. So that's right. The Canadian Voice of Women for Peace and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom have a parliamentary e-petition, 5129, that right now is being sponsored by the NDP defense critic Lindsay Matheson. So we're collecting signatures until January 6th. And we are asking Canada, of course, to engage with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, to sign it, to ratify it, to send an observing delegation to the next meeting of the parties of the TPNW, this important treaty to abolish nuclear weapons. They're having their third meeting in March in New York, and we're asking Canada to observe it. So just a little bit of important background on this treaty and Canada's non-involvement is that it was negotiated in 2017, and Canada didn't even participate in the negotiations. And then it's been open for signature since September of 2017, but Canada hasn't even signed it. And we are not joining the TPNW because of our membership in NATO. So we have this parliamentary petition before the House of Commons because we are continuing to put pressure on the Canadian government to take nuclear disarmament more seriously, because it's one of, you know, two of the existential risks that we're facing: climate change, of course, and this nuclear weapons threat. And we want Canada to join the TPNW, send a delegation to New York, and, you know, finally start showing some leadership on nuclear disarmament.
I remember there was a major push against nuclear warfare in the 1980s, you know, huge demonstrations. They had politicians all across the country. And then after the collapse of communism and the Soviet Union, those fears seemed to go away. So why do you think those fears are back now?
The fears are definitely back, and I think that this is one of the riskiest times of my life for nuclear weapons use, actually. And that is because we have this raging war in Ukraine that is really between nuclear-armed states. It's really a NATO proxy war in Ukraine against Russia. And NATO, of course, is a nuclear-armed alliance, and it's being, you know, fought on a major border country with Russia. Russia is a nuclear-armed state. Both the United States and Russia have the most nuclear weapons, about 6,000 nuclear warheads each. And, you know, this... The longer this war continues, the greater the risk for nuclear weapons use is. You know, we've seen now the United States and the UK approve Ukraine launching long-range missile strikes into Russia. These aren't nuclear, of course, but these are conventional missiles. And against Russia, which possesses nuclear weapons. I mean, there can be a mistake, a miscalculation. You know, why are we continuing this war when the nuclear risk remains? Like, this is just so reckless and dangerous. And this is why, you know, why we need to end this war in Ukraine and why we need to start talking seriously and taking action on nuclear disarmament, because it would be catastrophic for humanity if there was a nuclear weapons exchange between the NATO countries and Russia. So, and that's really what we're facing with this continuing war in Ukraine. It's facing its third year. There isn't an end in sight, and we need to end it.
Yeah, I remember, again back in the 80s that it, as you say, it's not just a deliberate use of nuclear weapons, but an accident could happen. Somebody misinterpreting a signal or something like that. But Canada itself does not contain any nuclear weapons, right? I mean, to many of us, concerns about nukes is a Russia versus America issue. It's out of our hands, no matter what we do. Is there any level that finds Canada as more than just an innocent observer?
Oh, Canada is deeply involved in nuclear weapons because of our membership in a nuclear armed military alliance in NATO. NATO has a nuclear deterrence policy where they claim that nuclear weapons are the supreme guarantee of security. And because of our membership in this alliance, we are very much involved. We are very much in complicit in, continuing with the existence of nuclear weapons that is one of the gravest threats that we're facing. So our position, Wilf and Vow, is to call for Canada to withdraw from NATO because of this nuclear weapons risk. And really, NATO is the greatest obstacle to nuclear disarmament because they're continuing to invest in the modernization of nuclear weapons. It's really the United States that is, dominating NATO. The United States is not in the near term going to get rid of their nuclear weapons. So, why are we participating in a military alliance with allies that are modernizing their nuclear arsenals and threatening first use? The United States threatens first use. Russia does not have a first strike policy. China doesn't have a first strike policy. And Canada claims to care about human rights and international law. But the continued maintenance of nuclear weapons, the modernization, the threat of first use is really a violation of our human rights, of our security, of international law. And Canadians need to think more critically about why we are continue to be a member of NATO and that hangs on to its nuclear weapons.
Could you talk a little bit about the efforts to get this the UN treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons way back in 2017? Elaborate on its history and what went into bringing it before the UN.
So there was a campaign launched by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace were involved with thousands of other activist groups around the world and advocated for 10 years at the United Nations for there to be a new treaty that said very clearly that nuclear weapons need to be abolished because the current treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that came into force in 1970, which Canada is a party to, has not been fully implemented. And the nuclear weapons states are not ha have not implemented the NPT. And so activist groups believe that a new treaty was necessary and, like I said, worked together very hard for a decade. And then in the fall of 2016, the UN General Assembly passed a motion that said that there could be negotiations for a new treaty that said categorically that nuclear weapons cannot be produced or maintained or used or modernized. They need to be completely abolished. So there's a new treaty was negotiated, like I said, at the United Nations in 2017. And it was chaired by the Costa Rican by Costa Rica, and most of the international community. There was 135 countries that participated in the negotiations, and then there have been 93 countries that have formally signed the treaty and 73 countries that have ratified it since 2017. So it reflects this new treaty, the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, reflects the global will to get rid of these worst weapons of mass destruction. And it's very exciting that it finally came into force in January of 2021. And over the past 4 years, there have been, two meetings of the party. There's going to be a third one, like I said, in March of this year in New York. And there's a lot of momentum behind this new treaty. And in fact, in December of 2017, this treaty was so momentous and this campaign was, so incredible by activists that the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons received the Nobel Peace Prize that year. And it was our honorary board member, Setsuko Thurlow, a Canadian-Japanese woman who survived the Hiroshima nuclear bomb attack by the United States in 1945. She was one of the honorary recipients of this Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. And, our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, would not even meet with her. Mm. After she had attended the ceremony for the Nobel Peace Prize and had received it on behalf of ICAN. So, there's a tremendous amount of interest and excitement behind this treaty. We're sending a delegation in March in New York, and we want Canada to be there as well and start taking steps to help rid the world of these weapons.
An election in Canada could happen in the spring. I mean, maybe even sooner than that. Based on your own lobbying efforts, is there a party or an individual who's promising to agree with your stance on nuclear weapons, or are they all unified to state militarism and NATO with their own nuclear deterrence capability?
So the NDP and the Green Party have been very public in their position to, oppose nuclear weapons and wanting Canada to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And there have been representatives from both the NDP and the Greens at the TPNW meetings. And so that's been really great. So at the last one, Elizabeth May from the Green Party and Heather McPherson, the foreign affairs critic for the NDP, she was at the meeting, and we've also had a Senator Mary Lou McFedrin as well. She is a former Val board member. She has also, attended the TPNW, but not in an official government capacity. And so that's what we need. But, there was in the fall of 2018, just before he passed away, the former Liberal leader, John Turner, signed an open letter with other leaders around the world, calling on all states, including Canada, to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So we know that there is, in the broader liberal community, former leaders, members of parliament, you know, who support nuclear disarmament and want to see Canada, you know, show leadership and join this important new nuclear ban treaty. So, you know, we need to continue to put pressure on the Liberal Party. We need to also put pressure on the Conservative Party. You know, we are expecting, of course, because there is so much, you know, public opposition right now to, you know, the governing Liberal Party, that, you know, we're expecting a new government and, you know, most likely, unfortunately, a Conservative party. And so, we need to continue to put pressure on the Conservatives to, you know, to take nuclear disarmament seriously. They don't have a very progressive foreign policy, as you know, and, you know, this is very concerning. Of course, because, you know, Canada is so close to the United States, and the United States is in a process of spending $1.7 trillion on modernizing their nuclear arsenals, and they don't show, you know, any interest in disarmament at all. You know, it's the United States that has been the greatest obstacle to disarmament at the United Nations, you know, blocking the Committee on Disarmament and, you know, blocking so many arms control, non-proliferation treaties. So, you know, it's our closest ally, and, you know, and we need greater, you know, public pressure in this country for Canada to do the right thing on disarmament.
In September of last year, Scott Ritter and a bunch of other activists for peace tried to make opposition to nuclear weapons and war the political issue of the campaign. And if and when an election breaks out in Canada, is this an aim that you intend to champion? And if so, how will you raise your voice beyond the petition?
So, the next federal election, just like the last federal election, Canada is going to, you know, join up with other peace groups across the country to, you know, call for a peace platform like we did in the last election. So we had, I think there were 9 positions that we had. And, you know, we called on all of the political parties to take seriously peace and disarmament and include them in their election platforms. And we're going to do the same thing. And nuclear disarmament is at the top of the agenda. You know, and there's so many things that Canada needs to change course on in terms of foreign policy. And certainly, you know, joining the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is one of them. But the other things, you know, that we need to be doing is calling for Canada to withdraw from NATO, cutting military spending, withdrawing our troops from Eastern Europe, calling back our warships from the Indo-Pacific region, starting to invest more in peace building and peacekeeping and stopping all of this NATO war fighting that we're engaged in. So, you know, we are definitely going to try to make these issues priorities in the next election. We're going to do everything that we can. And we're, you know, we're working on with other peace groups, building a mass peace movement in this country, because that's what's really needed. You know, we're involved in this umbrella network called the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. And people can engage in that by checking out the website peaceandjusticenetwork.ca.
Tamara Lawrence, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Tamara Lawrence is a member of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace and a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada. Her petition is available for signing as petition E-5129 at ourcommons.ca/petitions.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
In 2006, William Arkin, a renowned geopolitical analyst writing for Washington Post blog, revealed details relating to a declassified World War III scenario implemented by U.S. Northern Command, or U.S. NORTHCOM. It featured Nemazi, Irmingham, Rubeck, and Chiria, which are basically the alter egos of North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China. And it features a scenario where eventually, which escalates to nuclear war. So we're looking at a scenario where World War III is effectively breaking out in real time, that nuclear weapons are suddenly destructive but safe for civilians. And those of us who have taken the time to investigate will know that the bosses running the show are dangerously underinformed. We'll have a look at the threat of nuclear war situation in 2025 with a highly respected former guest of this program. Drago Busnik is an independent geopolitical analyst and military analyst. He's a regular contributor to Global Research. Drago has recently received the annual prize of the Mexican Press Club for his outstanding work on geopolitics and nuclear war, which mainstream media just does not address. So thank you very much for returning to the Global Research News Hour, Drago. In your writing, you mentioned several different vantage points by which a nuclear war could be triggered. One was in the Russia-Ukraine-NATO conflict. One was in the Middle East after nuclear-armed Israel targeted Iran. And one was actually in South Korea just last month. Maybe you could start there, because our listeners may not know too much about a nuclear strike possibly occurring there. It's not the first thing that comes to mind. Could you remind our listeners of essentially what happened in Korea and why?
Well, I want to remind people about the strange and unexpected martial law that was imposed in the country by President, now removed President Yoon. What people didn't know is that he wanted to start a sort of a confrontation with North Korea to justify this martial law, and he wanted to stay in power, and he needed a reason to do that, to accomplish that. And of course, how else are you going to accomplish that without having an actual, you know, emergency, a nationwide emergency? And for some reason, he and the people around him thought that it was a good idea to try to challenge the nuclear-armed North Korea into some sort of an attack. And for months before the martial law was imposed, North Korea was talking about these sudden drone incursions into the north, and including Pyongyang, that were coming from the south. And these news were completely discarded by everyone. Everybody was saying that North Korea was lying and that this was an overreaction, and they were trying to find a reason to attack South Korea and so on and so on. And when the martial law happened in South Korea, it was essentially discovered that these attacks were true. And these were launched on the orders of the former, now disgraced, South Korean defense minister, who even tried to commit suicide while in prison, obviously to avoid the embarrassment of having to admit that he actually listened to the orders from the president and that he ordered these drones to be launched. And of course, he couldn't explain it. Like, why would you want to launch drones at North Korea, a country that could obliterate South Korea in minutes? And of course, he had no viable explanation for that. And this is why he tried to commit suicide. And then we have the situation that the government tried to block the parliament from taking over the country from this tyrannical government that was essentially trying to caused this war. And there was also a tacit U.S. support, because the U.S. government doesn't want South Korea to have normal relations with either China or North Korea, because that removes the necessity for the U.S. military to be there. And of course, this is a massive problem, because for South Korea needs good relations with all of its neighbors, including China and North Korea, not just for security reasons, but also for economic reasons, especially in terms of its relations with China. China is a huge market for South Korea. It's also an important trading partner. And of course, it's an important market for South Korean pop culture. So there are, you know, very important growing ties between two countries. And if there's a very compliant pro-U.S. government in Seoul, then the U.S. doesn't have to worry about that. The U.S. can still use South Korea as a power projection point, not just towards North Korea, but also to China. And we can see that the U.S. is ready to go to all lengths, regardless how dangerous those moves are, to ensure that its vassals are kept in place and that they are, compliant. And the fact that in all three places that you mentioned, the Middle East, Russia, Ukraine, and of course the East Asia, in all three places, it's ready to go to the length of nuclear war just to ensure that its global power remains untouched. So, or it wants to increase it, essentially. So we can see that the people who are running the show in Washington, D.C., they've become verifiably insane, if they ever were normal. So I know it's a strong word, but I have no other way to describe it, because, you know, whoever promotes nuclear war cannot be a sane person.
Yeah, well, I know with the what happened in Syria last month, I mean, that came to a lot of people as a surprise, certainly came to me as a surprise, because I thought it was mostly resolved. I mean, is there another point that could potentially lead to war, like maybe something more targeting China in the East Pacific, or this is just the three scenarios? Yeah.
Of course. I mean, there's also the issue in the South China Sea, where there's the Philippines and Vietnam and these other countries that have these disputes over the islands and territorial waters. But of course, all of these could be resolved. It's not, a death or life issue. It's the problem is the U.S. wants to use all of these countries as sort of like a forward operating base that could be used to limit China's influence or to hurt China, because right now in the Philippines and also in Japan, we have the U.S. installing the previously banned medium and intermediate range missiles, all of which could be nuclear tipped or nuclear armed, if you want. Mm. And the issue is, of course, China is going to have to respond to this in kind, which means all of these countries will suddenly become targets, potential targets for a nuclear strike or a retaliatory nuclear strike by China. And again, any sane leader or a sovereign leader, at least, would want to avoid this. So the issue is, for a country the size of Japan, no matter how big it is or how unimportant of an economy it is, it doesn't have sovereignty, because why would you want to get nuked? Why would you want to have bases or nuclear weapons that are targeting another nuclear power that could easily retaliate? Because it's not the U.S. that's going to suffer the consequences of something like that. It's going to be the local people, the Filipinos, the Japanese, the South Koreans, or whoever. And then in the end, all of us, because at some point, a country like China is going to say, okay, enough is enough. We understand that we cannot deter the U.S. in the region, so we're going to try to deter the U.S. globally. And of course, if the U.S., you know, if the U.S. thinks it can compartmentalize conflicts, you know, that's a very optimistic way of looking at things, because nuclear powers are not going to allow the U.S. or anyone else to destroy them and then, you know, leave the U.S. unscathed. It doesn't work like that. The U.S. is going to be targeted directly, which is why I'm saying that these people in Washington, D.C. are insane, because they're risking the lives of 330 million Americans and the lives of 8 billion people around the world simply by pushing, you know, their aggression against the world. It's sort of like the world is on essentially at a breaking point, because these people cannot think straight.
Of the two major conflicts that we've in our program we've followed in detail, there's one being Ukraine now having the right from the United States to fire long range missiles into Russia, and the ongoing, you know, essentially terrorist tactics they're using, and Russia maybe firing Oreshniks, and that seems to be escalating all the time. But you also have the Middle East with basically, you know, Iran basically engaging Israel for the first time several months ago, and then now they're going into Syria, which is kind of a launching pad for you know, new escalations by you know some terrorist factions, you know, the ISIS people. I'm wondering which of those scenarios do you think is the more likely to evolve to the nuclear scenario, nuclear use scenario, do you think?
I think it's going to depend on how the U.S. and its allies and vassals and satellites in the region will react to Iran, because Iran right now is under a lot of pressure, because it is, with the fall of Syria to these terrorist proxies, Iran is cut off from its allies in Lebanon, specifically Hezbollah. And of course, this is going to be a big issue for them. There's also the problem that, as you mentioned, there are terrorists who are now expanding in the region. And for them, the concept of state borders means nothing. And all they want is to create chaos and death and destruction. And of course, for them, this is also a personal matter. It's not just about religion. It's about their personal desire to gain money and power. And they can get this if they give it, if it's given by the U.S. and its allies in the region. So we can see an incursion into Iraq very soon, because Iraq is essentially an ally of Iran, because its PMU units, these Shia militias, are part of the Iraqi military. They are very well connected with the Iranian military. So that means that, you know, the Sunnis and these other Takfiri terrorists, as they're called, they have the interest to go into Iraq. And of course, this could destabilize the country for God knows which time. In the last 40 years, we've seen everything from the Iran-Iraq war during the Saddam era to two invasions, of course, of Iraq. And then we had the ISIS uprising in 2013 and 14, which escalated to, you know, well, the destruction of pretty much half of the Middle East in the last 10 years or so. So what we see now is another rise of ISIS. It's just rebranded into other things like HTS and Free Syrian Army and so on and so on. And then if Iraq falls, or if it's pushed into another destabilization, then Iran doesn't have any other choice except to push back directly, which could be the reason for the casus belli for the U.S. and Israel and these other countries to directly attack Iran. And at this point, we don't know if Iran has nuclear weapons. There are some indications that it's building some nuclear warheads, or that it's very close to being able to. And then, of course, we have the U.S. and Israel, both of which are nuclear armed. So this brings us to another, you know, level of escalation that might lead to nuclear war. And in turn, it could also lead to global nuclear war, because countries like Russia and China cannot allow such destabilization of the Middle East and of the multipolar world, because Iran now is part of not just BRICS, but also the SCO, or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is extremely important for Eurasian security, because Iran is the country that prevents these terrorists from moving into Central Asia and affecting the global security and geopolitical and geostrategic security of Russia and China. And these things are going to affect the world. And it might seem that it's not something that concerns any of us, but it does, because we have no idea how, you know, global powers are going to react to those events, and it could lead to nuclear war.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and I'm here with Drago Buznik. He's an award-winning independent geopolitical and military analyst, and we're talking about the prospects of a nuclear war in 2025, or not too much beyond that. Drago, you're familiar with the scenario of Churia, Nemezi, and so on back in 2006. nearly 20 years later, there have been some changes, I think, that need to be revised in order to launch a so-called successful nuclear war. I mean, for instance, Russia appears to be a lot more more of a threat, you know, to the U.S. Single power status than it was before, and they've developed much more powerful missiles, the Urushni, for example. Could you go over some of the things that you, maybe the U.S. war planners need to keep in mind so that we're not launching a war that's in the that's so 2005, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, this specific document was declassified later on, and of course we know what they were thinking then. It's almost a certainty. I mean, it's pretty much a certainty that they already have updated versions of this document for 2025 and 2026 and 2030 probably. So I'm pretty sure they got that covered. They've updated the you know, their programs. That's sure. That's for certain. The problem is, from what I was able to see, many people in the Pentagon think that they can win a nuclear war, including against a country like Russia. They've been talking about these so-called decapitation strikes, not just against, you know, smaller countries, but even against Russia. So, and even against China. And one of the things they wanted to do, which is why I mentioned the connection between the U.S. and South Korea, they, you know, they know that they could use the South Korean territory to hit Beijing very fast, because Beijing is relatively close to South Korea. And the same goes for Ukraine, which is relatively close to Moscow. So, and of course, if they get Iraq again, if they manage to reoccupy the country, then Tehran is essentially in range in minutes. Again, we have this very dangerous concept that you can win a nuclear war even against, you know, countries which have the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, that being Russia, obviously. You mentioned Urushnik. The Urushnik is a conventionally armed IRBM, or intermediate range ballistic missile, but it can always be nuclear armed, because what most people don't know is nuclear warheads are actually lighter than conventional warheads. So a 1,000-kilogram nuclear warhead could have the destructive power of hundreds of Hiroshima bombs. On the other hand, if you put a regular conventional explosive on it, it can destroy, let's say, a military base or certain parts of military infrastructure that's very important. But the point is, If the Russians decide to respond in that way to this NATO aggression from Ukraine, essentially, where they're using these long-range missiles to strike Russia, Russia could certainly do that. Russia could launch a conventional strike with the Urushnik at a certain NATO military base. But NATO doesn't have such weapons. What does NATO have? What can NATO do to respond? It could launch a nuclear strike on Russia. And then, of course, Russia launches its own nuclear strike. This is where things could escalate this is why it's impossible to predict or control the level of escalation in nuclear war. And this is the dangerous idea, is that many in the Pentagon think they can do that. They have this so-called escalate to de-escalate strategy, where they think if they inflict enough damage, they could force the certain country to surrender. But why would any country surrender if it has a tool to ensure its own sovereignty and independence? In this case, in the case of Russia, they have around 6,000 thermonuclear warheads. So how are you going to control the escalation with a country like that? They might try that with Iran. Let's say Iran makes 10 nuclear warheads. They fire all 10. Now you can, you know, the U.S. and Israel and NATO could attack Iran, and then they can use this as a leverage to impose their will on Iran. But this is not achievable against Russia. So, you know, this is where we get to the question, who are these people who are making these war plans? Who are they? What their goal is? What is their strategic thinking? How can they be sure that whatever they're wargaming about is going to play out exactly as they want? Because you know, there's this saying in the military, every war plan survives until the first hour of the war, because it's an extremely dynamic situation where you have to be ready to, you know, massive changes to your war plans. You never know how things can, you know, go sideways. And this is the main issue. They don't understand. They don't have the concept. They don't understand the concept of escalation, or they simply refuse to accept the fact that these plans are going to fail the moment that the red button is pressed.
Yeah. Are there, you know, schisms that have developed, like within U.S. NATO on one side and on the Russia, China, Iran on the other, that I mean, I know you have countries like Turkey, for example, which seem to be playing economic and political games in ways with both the U.S. and with Russia. Is that, are there opportunities there which could be developed or, you know, that could give you know, peacemaking citizens around the planet an opportunity to, you know, deflect the prospect of nuclear escalation anyway?
Absolutely, and it's not just individual citizens and groups of people that are trying to achieve this, but there are actually countries within NATO, namely Hungary under Viktor Orban and Slovakia under Robert Fico. And both of these countries are speaking openly against the policy of constant escalation with Russia specifically. And the Turks, on the other hand, they're very much in line with NATO, but they also don't want nuclear war because they know they would be one of the first countries to be targeted because they're the second most powerful conventional military in NATO. They have dozens of NATO bases on their territory, including those with nuclear weapons. So they know that in the case of a nuclear war, those bases would be targeted, and they are on the territory of Turkey. So that means Turkey would, you know, suffer the consequences whether they want it or not. Also, Turkey is trying to build closer ties with Iran. This is not something that's going perfectly. Obviously, there are hiccups, and there's also the issue that Turkey is working with NATO allies to destabilize countries like Syria, which has been successful, unfortunately. But still, both Iran and Turkey, they want to maintain a normal relationship. And of course, Turkey would not want to see, if intentions towards Iran are true, and if they're not part of some ruse or something, then Turkey certainly wouldn't want to see a nuclear war on Iran happening anytime soon. But, you know, I mean, there are countries that are pushing against it, but still, they're not powerful enough. Unfortunately, they're not powerful enough to sway the opinion in the U.S. government towards another direction, but they're trying. And of course, this is important because it gives, you know, us, the regular people, the hope that we might actually have someone on our side who is part of the establishment and who understands the dangers of these, of such conflict. And, you know, I think it's important for us to talk about it. I think it's important for us to raise the awareness about the dangers of nuclear war, because there's not a living person on Earth that's not going to be affected by this. Mm-hmm. Like people who are completely oblivious to what's going on, or people who are not connected directly to whatever is happening in all those regions that we just talked about, they will be affected. Like a person in Brazil or Spain, or a person in Nigeria or Yemen or Vietnam or Canada, for that matter, all of us are going to be affected. No matter who you are, where you live, you're going to be affected by this.
Yeah, well, could you just maybe briefly paint us a picture based on your research of what all the nuclear weapons on the books would actually do to the planet beyond a lot of destructions from this baby nuke or whatever you call it? I mean, what is the consequence that people would see and thoroughly realize that, you know, we got to stop this war?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I can mention just several nuclear weapons. For example, the Hiroshima, the Nagasaki bomb was 21 kilotons, which is 21,000 kilograms of TNT exploding at once. For comparison, there are nuclear-armed torpedoes or drones torpedoes in the Russian Navy, which could carry 100 megaton nuclear warhead. So that's, in comparison, that's around that would be 50,000 times more powerful than the Nagasaki bomb. So if you can imagine 100 megaton, that's 100 million tons of TNT exploding at once. And they could have up to 30 of these torpedoes. And this is just like one weapon system. There are, in Russia, there are around 5,500 to 6,000 nuclear weapons, but now they are rearming because, of course, we have the new Cold War happening. There are around 5,000 nuclear weapons in the U.S., and that's around those two countries, Russia and the U.S., control around 90% of the world's arsenal. But there's also China, which is increasing its nuclear arsenal. It has around 500. That's the estimate. It could have more, but the latest estimate is 500 nuclear warheads. There's also India and Pakistan and the UK and France, all of which have hundreds of nuclear weapons. So the point is, like, even if we have 1,000 nuclear weapons hitting certain cities, it would be a bloodbath. It would completely destroy these areas. It would make them uninhabitable for years or decades. And of course, if we have so many nuclear weapons exploding at once in all of these areas, then it will be the end of our civilization as we know it. Everything that we take for granted, like, for example, the internet, will be gone. The EMP effect of a nuclear warhead will destroy your internet connection. You're not going to have it. Like, even if the bomb doesn't hit your city, the EMP effect is going to completely fry all electronics. And suddenly it will be...
Electromagnetic pulse.
Yeah, exactly. The EMP is the electromagnetic pulse. And, of course, that's going to take you back to the 19th century, whether you like it or not. So that alone should be enough of a deterrent for all of us not to have a nuclear war. Because, I mean, can you imagine 21st century people living in the 19th century and what sort of a humanitarian disaster that would be for all of us? So, again, that alone should be a deterrent. But, you know, I'm not to even mention the horrifying effects of a nuclear explosion on a person. And I would advise people to look up the word degloving and how dangerous that is. And a degloving is just a physical consequence of a nuclear weapon, like not even, like burns. You wouldn't even get burns, but a person would get degloved just by the sheer power for destructive force of a nuclear weapon going off. So, and can you imagine hundreds or thousands of these exploding at once? Also, countries like the U.S. and Russia have these nuclear-powered submarines with hundreds of nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles, SLBMs, submarine-launched ballistic missiles on these submarines. So even if Russia and the U.S. were to disappear tomorrow, they would still have the power to devastate the rest of the world with nuclear-powered submarines alone. So, you know, the combination of all these missiles and all these weapons that we have is something that is beyond deadly, because it would not just kill hundreds of millions of people, it would also arrest the possibility of a civilization recovery.
Okay. Drago, I really got to go, but I thank you for sharing all this information with our listeners. A great way to start the 2025. Thank you for joining us, and I hope we'll get back in touch real soon.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Drago Bosnick is an independent geopolitical and military analyst, and he's a regular of Global Research NewsHour, and he joined us from Serbia.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, join us for our look at Syria.
You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again.